Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We'll turn to national politics now with two guests' views on some fallout from the midterm elections. Later, we'll talk to Stacey Abrams campaign manager Lauren Groh-Wargo, who's now in a group that is suing the state of Georgia for allegedly diminishing people's right to vote. Right now, we'll talk to Charlie Sykes, former conservative talk show host from Milwaukee, about an intense conflict there in Wisconsin in which the outgoing Republican governor, Scott Walker, might sign a bill to curtail early voting for 2020, that of course is a presidential election year, and otherwise reduce the power of the Democrat who defeated him in the election. As some of you know, Charlie is now a contributor to the Weekly Standard and an MSNBC contributor and author of the book, How the Right Lost Its Mind. We'll touch on some other things in the news as well, including breaking this morning, President Trump saying he's going to nominate William Barr is the next attorney general. Barr served George H.W. Bush, and also reports coming out that John Kelly is about to leave as chief of staff. So, Charlie, welcome back to WNYC.
Good to be with you.
Before we get to your article in the Atlantic today called Why My Friend Scott Walker Should Not Sign the Lame Duck Legislation, do you know anything about William Barr and what this nomination for attorney general would signal?
Well, it signals that apparently the president's been listening to people in the Senate who have told him that he's going to have to come up with somebody with some strong credentials to get them confirmed. My friend Ben Wittes, who is the editor-in-chief of Lawfare, seems to think this is probably a relatively decent outcome given the alternatives. I guess the question that I have in my mind is, does William Barr know what he's getting into today? Does he know exactly what he is walking into, especially with some of the things that'll be breaking later today?
And breaking later today could be, will be, Robert Mueller filings in the Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort cases, also a Cohen filing by the U.S. Attorney's Office here in New York. What we don't know is if there's going to be much there for the public to see or if it's going to be largely redacted, but there might. So what will you be looking for in those filings, which are due by 5 o'clock this afternoon?
Well, yeah, number one, tempering expectations because of all the redactions that we saw from previous filings. But the expectation is that we're really going to get a much broader, deeper look at what Bob Mueller is looking at, what he knows, what sort of information that he's willing to lay out now. I mean, people keep waiting for the Mueller report to go to Congress. In a sense, it's certainly possible that he could be laying out that report in real time through these documents. And particularly with the appointment of a new attorney general, I think it becomes less likely that his investigation is going to be shut down. But he's certainly taking the steps to get information into the public record, into the court record, that is going to be very, very hard to ignore. So again, the big question is, what does Bob Mueller know? How does he know it? And how broadly and deeply is this going to go into the president's campaign, his White House, and his family?
Rudy Giuliani, of all people, seemed to put a little distance between himself and the president with an interview in The Atlantic that they're running alongside your Scott Walker piece today. He said answering the Mueller questions, which Trump answered in writing, was a nightmare. It took Trump 3 weeks to do what other people would do in 2 days, and he made some other comments. Do you take anything from Rudy Giuliani as a sign of anything larger going on at the White House? He doesn't usually distance himself from the president in any way.
Yeah, Rudy Giuliani, and of course, you know him a lot better than I do, but it's almost like he's transforming into Grandpa Simpson in front of our eyes. I just don't know. I don't know why he says some of the things he is saying, but that was certainly an interesting tell, because the president was trying to suggest that this was easy. You know, he didn't even need his lawyers. He just dashed it off because he has nothing to hide. But I think that if you put Rudy Giuliani's comments together with the president's tweets, you really get a sense of how nervous they are, the level of anxiety that it must be pervasive in the West Wing.
And the other report just breaking in the last hour or two, White House Chief of Staff John Kelly reportedly maybe about to resign. And my question for you, Charlie, would be your degree of alarm about that. Some people, I think, see Kelly as sort of the main, you know, responsible adult in the room doing what I think Senator Bob Corker called adult daycare of Donald Trump. How alarmed would you be if John Kelly leaves as opposed to, meh, it's all the same anyway?
Well, I think this has sort of been baked in. John Kelly's been going out the door for some time, and we're switching the metaphors. He's been dead man walking, and I think it's been increasingly obvious that if there are still adults in the room, the president's not listening to them anymore. So I'm not any more alarmed by that than I've been alarmed by watching the trajectory of this presidency.
Charlie Sykes, my guest on WNYC, contributor to the Weekly Standard and MSNBC, author of the book How the Right Lost Its Mind. And he's got an article in The Atlantic today called Why My Friend Scott Walker Should Not Sign the Lame Duck Legislation. We can also take phone calls for Charlie Sykes on anything we're talking about. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Remind people of your background. Charlie is Wisconsin governor, outgoing governor who lost his election to a Democrat last month. Scott Walker, really a friend?
Well, you'd have to ask him. I think at this point, this is somebody that I've known since the early 1990s. And, you know, in a sense, we kind of grew up together. But clearly, with the events of the last couple of years, we're certainly not as close as we are. As somebody mentioned on social media that, hey, if you were really friends, wouldn't you just pick up the phone and tell him as opposed to writing an article? And I suppose that is an interesting point. What I'm writing is to say, look, as somebody who, you know, can see things, can understand your point of view, what's happening in Wisconsin is a very, very bad idea. It is not just your political enemies who think this is a bad idea. You are really shooting yourself in the foot. So I was trying to offer it as friendly advice. Look, you know, Scott Walker is 51 years old. He's got a long life, long career ahead of him. Does he really want to leave office in this classless way? Does he really want to tarnish his reputation? Is he fully aware of how much this damages his image and whatever legacy he hopes to have? And, you know, sometimes you have to have somebody who you think is, you know, not necessarily throwing rocks at you all the time, telling you this is not really a good idea, and this is very much not in your interest to be doing this sort of last-minute lame duck legislation.
So what's not a good idea?
Well, you know, the sore loser legislation that they have been passing, to limit early voting, to limit the powers of the governor and the attorney general. One of the points that I make is that it is just simply not worth it. It looks terrible. It certainly is an attack on democratic norms. A lot of what they're doing is not going to survive court challenge. They are not going to be able to really. I think that the federal courts are likely to strike down the attempt to limit early voting, which seems petty and vindictive and undemocratic. So they're going through a lot of effort and they're taking a lot of shots, and they're going to get, at the end of the day, very little. To do it, but also it is the sense that it's all about tribalism and the petty.
Whoops!
Simply going to rig the game after you've lost it.
You predict in the article that the early voting rollback in this bill will probably be struck down in court.
Yep.
Tell our listeners in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, who may not follow Wisconsin politics, what that is. Is this a blatant attempt to make it harder to vote in 2020 when President Trump will be running for reelection, presumably against a Democrat?
Pretty much. You know, the politics in Wisconsin is relatively simple. You have two major bastions of Democratic electoral strength in Madison, Wisconsin, and in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And the story of the election this time was huge Democratic turnout in Madison, the Madison area, and in the Milwaukee area, which swamped the Republican votes in the rest of the state. Now, in Milwaukee and in Madison, they have very extensive early voting. They have you can vote earlier, you can vote for longer hours than pretty much anywhere in the state. So the Republicans are saying, well, we're just simply making it uniform. We're having rules that apply to rural towns will be the same as that apply to places like Madison and Milwaukee. And that's their argument. But the reality is that they're doing this really is kind of the, you know, the sore loser reaction. There are just too many votes from Madison and Milwaukee. What can we do? And again, it's pointless. It's not going to survive. And frankly, even if it did survive, it's not really going to change the outcome except to signal to the rest of the country that, you know, that we're going to react to an electoral defeat by making it harder to vote.
Take a step back for our Northeast listeners. And, you know, if what they know is that Wisconsin was maybe the single most shocking state to go for Trump in 2016, without which Hillary Clinton would be president today, and which a lot of people assumed was going to go for the Democrat in 2016. What's the big picture there going into 2020?
Well, I was also shocked, and I was here on the ground at the result. And there are a lot of analyses that, you know, running the Electoral College that have Wisconsin as the determinative state. It's very much a purple state. And the only reason that Donald Trump lost was, well, there were a lot of reasons. I mean, I'm sorry, that Donald Trump won Wisconsin was because Democratic voters in Milwaukee did not turn out in the numbers that they had for Barack Obama. But what's going on right now is that Republicans, by doing what they are doing, they are very much energizing that Democratic base. If that Democratic base is energized in 2020 the way that it was energized in 2018, the Republicans are in a lot of trouble in Wisconsin.
Is there a type of Democrat or an individual, if you want to name names, who you think would do best against Trump in that purple state of Wisconsin?
That's an interesting question, and it's hard to say given the fact that, I mean, what are there, you know, 40 or 50 Democrats running?
Looks like that, 1,500, 1,600.
I mean, there are several different dynamics. There's the question is, what will motivate the Democratic base? What will appeal to suburban Republican voters who might have voted for Mitt Romney but decided to sit out Donald Trump? And who's going to be able to appeal to blue-collar and rural voters in Wisconsin? So it's hard to say. I mean, it's certainly conceivable that you could have a Democratic candidate who could, check all of those boxes. But it's also possible to have a Democratic candidate that would alienate some of those swing voters.
Also, one of your recent articles on the Weekly Standard site is called A Speech in Search of a Candidate. And it's really interesting to me, and it's some donated speech writing by you for a Republican who might run against Trump in the 2020 primaries. Tell our listeners what's at the heart of that speech, and do you think there is any Republican who might give it?
As you can tell, I'm writing things that are sort of like Hail Mary passes, very, very high. I feel like Don Quixote sometimes. I was just trying to write, you know, what would it sound like for a Republican to stand up and say, hey, my fellow Republicans, we know who Donald Trump is and, you know, what he stands for, and here's an alternative vision. Rejecting the xenophobia, you know, rejecting the bigotry, rejecting the torrent of lies that come from him. I think at the moment, the reality is this is Trump's Republican Party. It is a huge uphill fight to mount a challenge, but you know, to the extent that someone should stand up and say, I at least want to provide people an alternative, that I can speak for the coalition of the decent. I mean, the kind of people that were watching the funeral of George H.W. Bush and say, you know, that's what I thought the presidency was about. Those are the values that I respect. Do I have no alternative other than to, you know, vote to renominate Donald J. Trump in 2020? Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping somebody will pick it up, although I'm not... I'm not counting on a unicorn for Christmas.
Yeah. And I wonder if this also relates to the news about, and a lot of our listeners may not have heard this, but about the conservative magazine that you contribute to, the Weekly Standard, founded by neocons like Bill Kristol and John Podoretz and originally owned by Rupert Murdoch. It's been in the news for financial problems. And a certain line of analysis says it's an indication that a Republican that's conservative, or I should say a publication that's conservative but does not support Trump, might not have enough of a market anymore. I don't want to put you in an uncomfortable position commenting on a place you contribute articles to, but how much, you know, to the extent you can say, do you think it's a reflection of the lack of interest in non-Trumpy conservatism?
Well, I certainly don't want to claim that I know more than in fact that I do. I think a lot of things are going on. The owners of the Weekly Standard apparently have decided that they're going to be investing very heavily in an alternative publication, the Washington Examiner, which has been somewhat friendlier to Donald Trump. And so we'll find out over the next week. I think the Weekly Standard has actually been doing well by the standards of, you know, ideological publications, none of which raise any money. So there is a choice here. But your larger question is, what is the fate of independent conservative voices in the age of Trump? And as you and I have talked about in the past, it is a very, very difficult environment. Conservatives have rallied around Donald Trump. There are a lot of people on the right who regard the role of the conservative media as to provide them a safe space to simply defend the president and attack his critics. And so when you have something like the Weekly Standard that has been willing to sort of stand athwart this and be independent and say, you know what, no, we are not going to jump on the Trump train, it creates a significant backlash, an undertow among conservative readers and investors about what are you doing there? Because they want the world to be binary. They want it to be tribal. And the Weekly Standard has been really has staked out a very, very unusual and I would say very courageous position under Steve Hayes, who is the editor in chief. We talk about courage, moral courage, taking a stand, standing by principle in this particular age. He did that. And we're going to find out whether he's paid a price for it.
And with Charlie Sykes at 212-433-WNYC, Stephen in Manhattan. Hi, Stephen. You're on WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. You're a national treasure.
Thank you, sir.
I wanted to ask the guest, we have the situation in Wisconsin with Republicans stripping power from the governor's office. The same thing happened in North Carolina year before last, and I seem to remember a couple years before that in Virginia when Terry McAuliffe entered the governor's office, there was a fight with his Republican state Congress stripping rights from or power from the governor. Do you think that this is a problem with Republicans, that they have a problem ceding power when they lose, or do you think that this is just kind of one or twosie out there that we shouldn't be concerned about? I think we should be concerned about it, which is why I'm posing the question, and I wonder how you see it since you come from that political side of the spectrum. Thanks.
Well, your question already provides the answer, which is there's clearly a pattern that's going on here, and it is this this culture that that all politics has to be smash mouth. It's all about winning. It is all about playing to your base, and I think you see that reflected. I think the long term damage from this is going to be significant. I mean, if our politics really becomes winner take all, and we rejigger the system or rewrite the rules if we don't like the outcome, then you really have damaged democratic norms. And unfortunately, I think our democratic norms are much thinner and much more fragile than we had realized before. And there was a time when I think that you had voices on both sides of the aisle who said, look, let's acknowledge this fragility. Let's do the classy thing because it is necessary for our system of government to operate. And I see that less and less now.
And in fact, there are, as the caller says, a number of lingering state-level conflicts since the midterms. Our guest right after you will be Stacey Abrams' campaign manager from Georgia, who's got a voting rights lawsuit there. I think Michigan Republicans are doing something like you're describing in Wisconsin. And we know the ballot stealing suspicion, at least in North Carolina, that could have gotten a Republican elected to Congress there through some kind of absentee ballot shenanigans in both the primary and the general election. Do you know anything about have you followed the North Carolina case at all?
Oh, very, very much so. It's probably the worst case of election fraud that I can remember. We often joke about people in, the dead voting in Illinois in 1960. But, if in fact these stories are true, and they certainly appear to be, you have, criminal activity that is specifically designed to steal people's vote in the most literal possible way. And of course, what's ironic about this has been that, there's been all of this talk about voter fraud, which has, never been really documented on a wide scale. And now we have the most dramatic, most egregious case of election theft. And it's interesting who is not really talking about this. But this is going to be a national story. And, going back to the caller's point, Republicans may win these small, petty little fights in these lame duck sessions. But if we come out of this and the public perceives the Republicans as the party of voter suppression, undermining the democratic norms, this will have a long-term, possibly generational effect. So they're trading the short-term, petty, vindictive wins for really squandering their reputation for a very, very long time.
One more call. Peter in Rego Park, you're on WNYC with Charlie Sykes. Hi, Peter.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Mr. Sykes, one thing I don't understand, and I'd love to be able to ask Senators Corker and Flake, and maybe you've spoken with them, why they didn't run. I understand that in a Republican primary, they probably would have lost, but the chance to stand up and say, these are Republican values, this is where we should stand.
Well, we don't know yet about, there were 17 Republicans running in 2016, and Trump, beat the other 16. Do you think Corker or Flake, with the positions that they've taken in the Senate, the way that they've been willing to speak against Trump, though they both realized they were going to lose their reelection battles because of that, and so they both didn't run for reelection, do you think either of them might run in 2020?
Not Corker. Flake's certainly a possibility, and there are other names out there that are possible. John Kasich, I think, might run. I think that Ben Sasse, who knows, might be out there. I'm very interested to know what Mitt Romney's going to do in the Senate. But I think the caller was also saying, why didn't they run for reelection just to plant the flag?
I misunderstood that.
And the answer is there's no question that Jeff Flake would have lost for reelection. It would have been a cause worth fighting for. I don't know the politics of Tennessee well enough to tell you what would have happened with Bob Corker. And it's very easy to say that other people should have, put their lives on the line. I just wish that that Bob Corker and Jeff Flake would have spoken out more strongly and more consistently and used their incredible leverage and clout in the Senate to force some, some action, which they did not do. I also wish that some of their eloquent criticisms had inspired other members of the Senate to stand up for the institution and for some of these fundamental principles, but that did not happen.
Charlie Sykes, Weekly Standard and MSNBC contributor, author of the book, How the Right Lost Its Mind, and of the new article in The Atlantic called Why My Friend Scott Walker Should Not Sign the Lame Duck Legislation. Charlie, we always appreciate it. Thank you.
Brian, thank you so much.